We'll be very respectful of your time. I know that everybody's got busy scheduled. I'll speak, then Rabbi Stern will speak, and then we'll give some time for questions. So, I was asked to talk about it. The ethical issues for prenatal diagnosis. And some of you may not even know what prenatal diagnosis is. So, I'm going to do a brief introduction there, talk about a little bit about what's standard of care for physicians and the science, and then we'll get into the ethical issues within the Torah. So, there's actually two forms of prenatal diagnosis. There's that that's pre-pregnancy, which relates to mom and dad, which indirectly can affect the fetus, and prenatal diagnosis of the fetus itself. And what I mean by pre-pregnancy is that people can get tested in, before they ever get pregnant as to whether they're carriers of certain diseases. And I'm sure everyone in the room is aware of Tay-Sachs being a Jewish disease, and there's some others. But I put some of this material on the desk where you came in. There's actually 25 Ashkenazic Jewish diseases, and there are panels for those. And in our Jewish patients, we offer that panel to those individuals, keeping in mind that it's totally voluntary. But it is something that one can do prenatally, prior to pregnancy, but it's also something that we can do on the first prenatal visit, as well as other blood testing that we'll do on the first prenatal visit for, in our practice, about 130 other mutations that can occur. But the big ones are cystic fibrosis, Fragile X, spinal muscular atrophy, is one of the Ashkenazic ones. Fragile X is not. But cystic fibrosis definitely is. So we offer that. But then if we get into the fetal testing, if we go back 20 plus years, the gold standard was amniocentesis. And amniocentesis was done at around 18 to 20 weeks of gestation. And it was a somewhat risky procedure. It was putting a needle through the mother's abdomen into the amniotic sac that surrounds the baby. Withdrawing some of that fluid and growing the chromosomes. And it was specifically designed for women over 35 because that was where the risk of Down syndrome increased. And at that point, at 35 to 40 anyway, the risk of Downs was 1 in 270. The risk of the procedure was 1 in 500 of miscarriage. And so as in medicine, everything that we look at is benefit versus risk. So if the benefit outweighs the risk, then it's worth doing. If the risk is higher than what the benefit you're going to receive, we don't do it. But so 1 in 500 is less risky than 1 in 270, so that's kind of how they decided on age 35. We didn't do it on younger women unless they had a previous child with some type of problem that could be determined by amniocentesis, such as Down syndrome or other specifically chromosomal abnormalities. But times have changed. And amniocentesis was considered an invasive procedure. And nobody, regardless of what kind of procedure you're having done, nobody likes invasive because it's invading your body. And although it was done under ultrasound guidance, we now have procedures that are considered non-invasive. And according to my organization, the American College of OBGYN, we're supposed to offer it to everybody, regardless of age, although those over 35 are at more risk. But there are now testing that can be done. There's something called first trimester screening in the first trimester of pregnancy, which is up to 13 weeks. And you can do a specific targeted ultrasound between 11 and 13 weeks, looking at such things as the fold behind the baby's neck, looking at the nasal bone, and combining that with three specific blood tests, that is a very good screen for Down syndrome and other chromosomal abnormalities, which we call aneuploidy. But these are very targeted. It's what we call a targeted ultrasound looking at specific markers. Again, it's all screening. And it's not the definitive test, but if you have a negative screen, you don't have to do anything further. And in many cases, that alleviates fear and anxiety in individuals. Then there's been a new test that's come out within the last 3 to 5 years called fetal DNA, which is a simple blood test from the mother. And from that blood test from the mother that we can get at 10 weeks, we can actually establish chromosomal abnormalities there, as well as the gender of the baby. Now, a lot of people want this test. They'll come to my, we want to know the sex of the baby. And that's really all we want to know, and we want that blood test. It's the wrong reason for doing it. But, you know, sometimes you have to do things that, if people want it and they want to pay for it, then you do it. But we're going to let that ethical discussion come after me. Now, there are some considerations where you do want to know the sex of the baby. Hemophilia, for instance. If you have a family history of hemophilia, it's going to show up in a male where it won't show up in a female as often. So there are some times when that's important. But in this day and age, as I was talking to Dr. Rabbi Stern, people now have what we call reveal parties. This is they want to know the sex of the baby. They have somebody in the family that gets it from me, and then they have a party and they reveal the sex prior to the baby's birth. And there's some other things that go on now, but those are some of the things that occur. Now, with this prenatal testing, if it comes out positive, then there becomes the ethical issue. And you have to look at it, is it a lethal problem? Is this a lethal situation with the baby? So if the baby is going to die at birth, do you want to terminate this pregnancy early on? Or are you going to make the mother continue the pregnancy until she delivers and then watch this baby die in a few hours? Or is this a condition that is compatible with life but with special needs? And again, these are some of the ethical considerations that we come up with. But if you have a negative screen, again, we don't do anything further. If we have a positive screen, then we suggest the full diagnostic testing, which would be amniocentesis, because then you're getting a definitive answer. But sometimes on the ultrasound alone, you'll see cardiac defects, that the chromosomes may be normal, but there are other considerations. Then as we go through pregnancy beyond that, then at 18 weeks, 16 to 18 weeks, there's a blood test called an alpha-fetoprotein. This one is a test for spina bifida, which is a defect in the spinal cord which can cause paralysis, or something called anencephaly, which is failure of the brain to form. Well, anencephaly is lethal. Spina bifida is not. Again, that'll get discussed further. But I don't want anybody in the room to think that when we're talking about prenatal diagnosis, that means that if there's a problem, that you have to terminate the pregnancy. I mean, all patients come in and say, I don't want the testing done because I wouldn't abort anyway. Well, that's not the reason for doing it. The reason is for knowledge. And knowledge is a good thing. And, if someone says to me, well, I'll take what God gives me. And that's fine. I don't care. I have a duty to present what we can do, but I can't force anybody to do it. But if somebody is going to have, for instance, a Down's child, there are support groups that they can get contacted with before they have the baby. They can meet other families that have Down's children and kind of know what to expect. So I don't want anybody thinking that all we do is do this for the reason of terminating a pregnancy.
Are there medical interventions that you can use that knowledge
to apply? Yes, and there are certain conditions that you may find in utero that need immediate surgery after birth. And it's obviously important to know those things ahead of time because you want to be in the right place at the right time to get that surgery, whether it be a heart surgery. There's something called a tetralogy of flow that you need to do immediately. There are conditions where, let's say the intestines are outside the body, and you can't do anything about it in utero, but immediately when the baby's born, that can be fixed. So you want to make sure that you're in a hospital where that can be done. And at least in Denver right now, there's only one hospital where that neonatal surgery can be done, and that's Press St. Luke's. So this lady was planning on delivering at Rose, for instance, then we would change all of that so that she would be delivered at the hospital where the neonatal surgeons would be available immediately to take care of that problem. then, again, with this prenatal screening, again, it's low risk for women under 35, but we do offer it to everybody. But again, if someone's over 35 or has had a previous problem, we can do some of these non-invasive testing, and they can determine what they want to do from there. And then there's just simple anxiety. Some women are so anxious with their pregnancies, either because they've had a previous problem or they're just made up that way, that they say, I can't deal with this pregnancy unless I know my baby's okay. And we can never give 100% assurance, but we can give this testing and say, at least from these tests, we know that things are normal. And then the anxiety lessens and they can continue through the pregnancy. Because sometimes, you know, if these women are super anxious, they're going to need to be on medication. And we try and minimize medications in pregnancy, obviously. And then at 20 weeks, we always do, again, with patient's permission, a 20-week ultrasound, which is halfway through the pregnancy. Pregnancy is 40 weeks. And you can determine gender at that time as part of it, but that's not the reason for doing it. The reason for doing it is looking at the baby head to toe, at all of the organ formations and making sure everything looks normal, because you may pick up something at that time that you couldn't see earlier that may necessitate that surgery later on, or finding something that, you know, is lethal at that time, or that you find something that maybe you do need to look at something else or chromosomes at that point. I put some materials over where Rabbi Haman is sitting. Then at the end, if you would like, and you know, there's a list of the 25 Ashkenazic diseases, carrier screening. It talks about what the risk is in the Ashkenazic population of having a carrier. But keep in mind, you know, let's say it's a 1 in 40 of being a carrier. Well, in order to present itself, both parents have to be a carrier. So it actually would become 1 in 40 squared. So it's...
And even then, it's only 25%.
And then it's only 25% chance that it'll be actually happen. 75% of the chance it won't. You know, this is a very brief overview of prenatal diagnosis. I could sit up here for 2 hours and talk about it. But we'll go on, and then we can answer questions or get deeper into it, depending on what everybody wants to do. So I'll turn it over to Rabbi Stern.
Fantastic. If it's all right with you all, I'm going to sit down. Just a little more comfortable sitting. Thank you, Dr. Goodman. That was fantastically interesting, even though I heard a lot of it last night. If anyone has any clarification questions for Dr. Goodman before we continue, that would be a good idea. Bruce.
If you do screening, do you typically screen both parents prior and during? Or?
Well, most of these diseases are what we call autosomal recessive. So that means you have to have two partners with the same thing. So, for instance, with Tay-Sachs, if you were a Tay-Sachs carrier, then we would have to test your partner. And if she was, then you have a 25% chance of that occurring. On the other hand, if you're negative, we don't have to test the other partner, because even if they're a carrier, it's not going to express itself. And in the office, like, if we find on the first visit we do a blood test for, let's say, cystic fibrosis, and the woman is positive, then we'll have the husband come in and test them.
Okay. I'm not checking my phone for text messages. I just don't have a watch on me. I'm going to keep checking my phone. Just heads up. So let's start. I want to talk generally, just to give a bit of a background, at first about the idea of testing, trying to find mediums to figure out things, to ascertain future events, due diligence versus perhaps faith, a concept that has a number of ramifications and certainly applies to many different things. So I guess to kick this off, let's start with, if you guys have your sources, if you look at number one, we have a verse in Dvarim that says, you shall be wholesome with Hashem your God. Tamim pia im Hashem Elokecha. You shall be wholesome with God, which seems to indicate on a simple level that we should, that it's advising us to try to remain simple with our faith of God and not try to figure everything out. And Rashi explains this a bit more in depth, which is source number two. And he says, go with him in wholeheartedness and look to him. Do not investigate the future. Rather, whatever occurs to you, accept wholeheartedly. Now, obviously, this Rashi is a bit, you know, we have to know how to apply this piece of information. We can see that this might be over applied to a situation where you have, let's say, certain Christian sects that say, well, we won't use doctors because if you're using a doctor, then you don't believe in God. That's certainly not a Jewish perspective at all. I just want to get a little background on how to apply this from a halachic perspective. So there's two very famous opinions regarding this. And that is those of the Lahoris Lenasson and Rav Moshe Feinstein. Lahoris Lenasson, Rav Moshe Gestetner, he has an interesting take. He says what we're talking about is people who are using divination devices, all sorts of ways to find out the future. They're throwing dice, they're using methods to find out the future. Now, whether or not that works, leave that to the side. At least the idea was that he said that this prohibition is specifically for those who are trying to find some sort of way to find out something that is not in front of them, something that's in the future. There's a clear difference between that and a medical test. A medical test will measure something in front of us, something here. Now, we may deduce from that there's a risk. Right? So what Dr. Goodman is talking about is measuring for something that the doctors can see. They can test for. And what they're seeing is something that is there. That may be just a marker. That may be definitive depending on the scenario. So you may find a marker that will say that if there's an extra thickness in the back of the neck of the fetus, so then that perhaps would be a marker that the child may be born with Down's. So that may be reason to try other testing and work further towards that. But it's not definitive, and it's not a matter of fortune telling. We're testing something that's immediately in front of us. So according to Lahoris Lenasson, that would not be considered a breach of tamim tia, of remaining wholesome with God. Whereas Rav Moshe Feinstein has a different perspective. He applies this more broadly. He understands that this is a broader application, and in all probability, not in all probability, but Rav Moshe is garnering this from the Rashi that we read in source number 2, where he seems to say this as a broad thing. Accept wholeheartedly that which God is providing to you. Don't try to spend too many efforts on the future. Well, Rav Moshe, though, although he applies this, it's somewhat limited in its application. And that is, as we'll see in greater detail as we progress, that when something's within what we call standard of care, perhaps, or the normal commonplace way of keeping ourselves safe and healthy, so then Rav Moshe would not feel that would be considered to be a breach of tamim tia. So, for instance, I guess to apply this a bit further, there is an opinion that makes distinction between somebody who's sick and somebody who's healthy. The halakhic discussion is about somebody who wants to go and seek out alternative medicine. He's going to go and he's going to use some sort of unproven, perhaps quack medicine that doesn't have any scientific basis. And there's a healthy person who wants to use these methods. So regarding that, the halacha in this case would be, you shouldn't do it. Why? Because it says, Tamim tia m'Hashem l'kafa, you shall be wholesome with God. You shouldn't try to follow these things. Whereas somebody who's sick, who has a serious problem, and he hasn't found a medical response to, he would be allowed to. So what's this? So that sort of differentiation is a bit troublesome, because which one is it? Is it okay or not? So there's a Maharal which really gives us a tool to understand this entire subject better. And he says that the prohibition is to act unreasonably. Obviously, you're going to have to take great care in defining reasonable. But his understanding is, the Maharal says that in so much as we are following a normal, reasonable method of trying to figure out what we need to figure out, then that doesn't show any sort of breach of wholesomeness or lack of faith in God. We're simply dealing with our options in a way that's responsible. Now, for a healthy person to seek out, sort of out of the range of normal alternative medicine, that's an unreasonable thing to do. For him to go get screening from a shaman when he's not sick is unreasonable. It's not proven. There's no reason to do that. In contrast, a person who has an illness that's very it's progressing and doesn't seem to have a way to deal with it, for him to try an alternative medicine would be reasonable. It's a reasonable thing to do. I don't know what to do. There's a need, and so on. So therefore, with something like that, we have a better way of applying the differentiation between the different scenarios wherein we would be allowed to seek out alternate things and when it would be considered, no, that's a breach of being wholesome with God. With that in mind, let's take a look at number three. Number three is where Moshe Feinstein writes in a responsa. He says as follows, and this is, you know, somewhat of a paraphrase. Even though there's a small minority of children who are born with Tay-Sachs, and the verse, you shall be wholehearted with Hashem, your God, is applicable, as Rashi explains it, since it is now possible to check in a simple fashion, it can be argued that to not do so is like closing one's eyes to seeing what is visible. And therefore, he writes, it is fitting for one who wants to get married to check himself, and he's referring to doing pre-marriage testing of you know, blood testing to find out if you're carriers and so on. And Moshe really extends this with a number of different, I guess, conditions or the way he'd want to do it. He was concerned that people who would do this testing would then be labeled as, oh, you're a Tay-Sachs carrier. And everyone would know that, and perhaps when marriage ideas would arise, people would say, no, we don't want to get married to a Tay-Sachs carrier. So he felt that this was something really important not to publicize. And there's a system in place today called Dor Yesharim, which is used to a very large extent, which is a system where young boys and girls who are reaching marriage age but not quite there yet will get a blood test, and they'll get a number, a card with their number on it. They won't get the results of their blood test, and they'll do a panel, and I'm not sure if it's the extent of the panel that Dr. Goodman mentioned, but probably similar to the first panel, not the second optional panel that he mentioned. And it'll test for all the big ones, and then when a person decides to go out with a certain girl, so then they'll both give in their numbers, and then they'll be told, there's a problem, there isn't a problem. So this way, this information is kept in a way that's less detrimental and not, but...
I'm not sure if this is well-known in the secular Jewish community, but in the German Orthodox community, it's very common that if you do this before you actually will make a commitment to get married, that you do that, and everything's confidential. I think it would be a very big plus if we can get this word out to the broader Jewish community. I think that it's an amazing system that keeps, it allows you to do these testing, but it keeps it all confidential.
Why not tell the person involved, what's the heart of telling me that I'm a carrier or I'm not a carrier?
The policies that they decided in kind of making, you know, when you're talking about groups of people, they decided, I read up on this once, they decided that some people could, some people will get, you know, all, you know, emotionally affected by having them thinking that it's terrible, and it's not. It's just a carrier. We're all carriers of something. But they just made a policy, and they have the system, and it works, and it's...
Ramosha was also concerned about public people being shamed or people being nervous, even if doctors would assure everybody that being a Tay-Sachs carrier is totally not an issue if your partner isn't, and so on, and there's no, you're not a second-class citizen. But he was concerned that this is going to become a public issue where people are going to feel bad and they're going to be nervous. And
this is a system that's been around for at least 30 years. I know I did before I got married.
I did before I got married, too, as a test, but they told me.
One more point
broadly on this topic that I want to bring up before we continue on to some of the more, before we veer off of this idea of Tamantia, which is a way to apply this general principle, whether or not to test. Should we be, is testing or trying to find out what's going to happen a breach of faith? So we said a few ideas. We said, according to the Horus Lenazan, you're not trying to find something out, you're measuring what's there. We said, according to Moshe, would say that might be a problem, but in so much as it's a normal thing to do. The technology is there, and not doing it, he says, is akin to closing your eyes. You're avoiding a problem. You should be. Therefore, he felt that it was absolutely appropriate to look for things. Now, there's what I mentioned. I used the terminology before of standard of care, and we talked about this last night when we were, you know, going over the topic. I would imagine there's going to be a difference. I imagine that science and the rabbis might diverge on what's considered standard of care. And I'll get back to that a bit later. But at least in so much as something is commonplace and acceptable, and a good idea, then it wouldn't be considered a breach of Tavimtia, even according to the more stringent opinion of Rav Moshe Feinstein. The last point that I wanted to mention is that of Rav Eliashiv. And Rav Eliashiv gave a fantastic, a really interesting idea regarding the issue of health, of life insurance. And I don't really, it's a really different tangent. I don't want to go deeply into it, but when life insurance was really becoming more popular, there were certain rabbis who were against it for a number of reasons. Rav Eliashiv felt that even if a single individual should, from his own perspective, not be concerned with dying young and leaving over his family in need of money and so on, so that he's buying into it. And perhaps you might argue that from the individual perspective, it might be a breach of being wholesome, wholehearted with God to buy life insurance. Maybe perhaps for a younger person would be different than for a more elderly person. But he said, from a community perspective, it certainly wouldn't be. It means as a community, it would be important for us to be bigger-minded, to try to have a macro view of things. And so much as choosing to have the community do something that is helpful for everybody, then it becomes, it's certainly not a breach of this prohibition of Yishuv, or actually positive commandment, to be wholehearted with God. So in that context, I think we can apply that idea a little bit to what we're talking about, is that perhaps even if one would say that I don't need to test for this or that, or I'm not worried about it, or I feel that my level of faith is above that, but as a community we should be testing for these things so that we lower the risk factor for the entire community as a whole. Let's move forward to number 4 and 5. So let's talk a little bit about gender, what we call little reveal parties.
Yes.
Seems a little preposterous to me, but so there is let's read the number 4. It's there's a medrash. It says as follows: 7 things are concealed from people, and one of the 7 that he lists is what a woman is bearing. Essentially, he's talking about the gender of the child. One of the commentaries on the medrash, number 5, says as follows. He gives the rationale. It's not really a rationale, but he explains a rationale for why it is that in those days it was a fact, an absolute fact, that nobody would know what the gender is. And he says if it would be known, and the father and mother would be in distress during the pregnancy, especially if she is not, I mean, that's my own word, if she is not expecting the gender of their choice. And also, if they know that she is expecting what they desire, the joy would be minimized at the birth, and she would not have the proper recompense for her birth pains. Okay? So, he's trying to explain that there may be there's a rationale why we wouldn't want to know what the child is. So one can argue, well, I want to know. And I'll be much happier if I know. And I feel like my nerves will be allayed by knowing. Now, to be clear, the Medrash is not saying it is forbidden to find out the nature. It's noting that it's something that we don't know. It's not something that's known to us. We generally just don't know what the gender is. Now, Dr. Goodman mentioned that one of the things that people will do is ask for this early, unnecessary blood test to try to find out the gender. Some of them have this in mind that they don't want a specific gender. Some of them just want to make a reveal party. We've discussed that there are certain cultures where having female offspring is so bad. It's a really disturbing idea that having female offspring is so bad, and it's so glorified to have male children, that if they find out early on that they're having a female, a perfectly healthy female, they'll abort, which is a horrifying idea, but at least to my mind. But there's something else here, which is, I think, notable, and that is that something has changed today. And that is that we do ultrasounds. There's processes that we do which, throughout the normal process, will reveal what the gender is, at least to the technician. Now, we may or may not tell that to the parent. So what happens now is that we're not talking about making new testing in today's day and age. We're not talking about whether or not you're allowed to request testing. We're talking, I mean, perhaps we would talk about that, but at least, let's say, when it would be, it's information that the technician has. The question is, do you want to know? So perhaps you might feel in line with what the Yafei Torah says in number 5 and say, I don't think, it's better not to know. There are those who would say that there's a concept of ayin hara, that there's some sort of evil eye to know. You don't want to try to focus on that too much. But minimally, it seems that once it's already known, we're not talking about doing some sort of invasive or non-invasive testing to try to find this out. We're not opening a can of worms. We're not going to do a blood test, which, as Dr. Goodman mentioned, will cause us to now be cognizant of potential problems, which will take us down the rabbit hole of further testing and then perhaps ultimately some invasive testings or other things, or just being a mess of nerves throughout the entire pregnancy. We're talking about simply wanting to find that out or not wanting to find that out. And I feel like that's something that would just be dependent on person's leaning in this context, because it's not as much halachic as ashkafic, because it doesn't pertain to whether doing a test that might be inappropriate. That's already done. There's an ultrasound. Now, whereas if somebody would want to do a test early on simply for the reason of finding out the gender, and there's no practical ramifications, so then that would certainly be inadvisable, because as Dr. Goodman mentioned, you're causing the need for further testing, and if you find out something that you wouldn't normally be concerned about, you may follow this down into a place which is more problematic, as we'll discuss shortly. Now, there's another perspective here, and that's a question of lifnei iver. Right? We're told that we're not allowed to cause somebody to sin. We're not allowed to help somebody in their sinning as well. And so there's two different things. There's causing somebody, and then there's helping, which is misayeah. So there's a lucky discussion, which I don't think that we have any...
Would you define the term,
either. To before a blind person, do not place a stumbling block. Okay, so in the context, although that sounds like don't trip a guy who can't see, but one of the intended meanings of that verse is that do not put somebody in a position where they will stumble, and that could be by giving them bad financial advice or giving them the opportunity or helping them do a sin.
Can you talk a little louder?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, I will try to project a little bit better.
Sorry. I'm the one who can't hear, it's okay. But if
you're not.
I'm not. Okay. It's just a noisy fan.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so there is a... Tzitz Eliezer discusses this, one of the responses for compilations, it's not a compilation, but his response we'll discuss a number of times today. He discussed this issue. Now, one of the issues that have been discussed in previous Torah for Tycoons, I wasn't here, was abortion. And we're going to touch on that a little bit now, but I'd like not to go too far down the rabbit hole with this. But it's pertinent to today's discussion in this regard. Because, as we discussed, there are times when a person wants to know this information because the main question is, do I or do I not abort? Now, as Dr. Goodman stressed, and this is really important, today, and it probably even then, this wasn't the only reason to find this out. Right? Besides for the emotional issues of support and so on, there's also the practical application like that you talked about of different interventions or being prepared to deal with things, and ultimately this could be the difference between saving the child's life or not. So this is really practical. But leaving that aside for a moment, there's a question of what happens if somebody comes in and says, I want to know this test because I want to know if I'm going to abort or not. So now we've entered into the issue of lifnei iver, whether or not you're allowed to help them by doing the test and therefore enabling them to then make their inappropriate choice to abort in certain scenarios. So just very, very briefly, to wildly oversimplify Rabbi Fleischer's class on abortion, there are two extremes in contemporary rabbinic thought regarding abortion. And so outside of a scenario where the mother's lives are is in danger, there's the opinion of Moshe Feinstein. Moshe Feinstein, who was certainly considered to be one, if not the greatest sage of the time, his opinion was that it is murder to kill fetus. And therefore, unless there's an issue with endangerment to the mother, there's not going to be very much wiggle room. In contrast, the Tzitz Eliezer had a more lenient view over here, and he felt that there could be scenarios where it would be permitted, for instance, a fatal defect, or perhaps even in extenuating circumstances, something like Down syndrome, where it's not fatal. Now, nonetheless, everybody would be in agreement that you certainly can't give a carte blanche ruling that it's permitted to abort, and in the vast majority of cases, it would be problematic. So the question then is, are you allowed to do this testing if the purpose is, if there's a possibility of causing the person to abort? To which he said that you certainly allow, it's not an issue of causing somebody to sin if you don't know that they're going to abort. It means they have the options. So they may decide to do that, and that's their prerogative, and it's not a good choice, but he says a number of things. He says, first of all, it may very well be, and this is according to his view, not Rav Moshe Feinstein's view, that in a certain scenario, the testing will determine a situation where it would be halachically permissible to abort. So that's one point. The other point, he says, is that you don't know that they're going to abort with certainty. So he says there's no issue for the doctor to do the testing from his perspective. Now, we're not talking about whether or not the testing should be done, but whether the doctor who's Jewish is allowed to say, I'm not going to do that testing, whether he's allowed to say, I need to do that testing, or does he have to say, well, I can't do that testing because I'm going to cause somebody to sin. So in this case, he says it would be permissive to do the testing.
So are you in point number six about murder?
We're about to get to that.
Okay.
So this is where we get to the application. So I mentioned the background of Moshe Feinstein for this very point, because we're going to see six in a moment, but just the heads up in advance is that, like I said, Ramosha felt that it was forbidden to abort unless the mother's life was in serious danger in all cases. And so Rav Moshe Feinstein would say, well, what's your point of doing the testing? So let's see number six. Even if we know clearly that the child like this will survive, even for a short time, and with illness the entire time, it is not possible to permit the murder of the fetus, for there's a prohibition of murder even for this fetus, just as for a healthy fetus. Rav Moshe is not willing to make a distinction between a fetus that has a fatal defect and a regular child. Because perhaps, and I do not know what I'm about to say with absolute clarity, but perhaps there can be a comparison between a child that has a fatal defect with somebody who is a live human being who has a fatal defect, who's going to die within a year. There are certain halachas that would pertain differently to such a person that they're not entirely considered to be in every single aspect of life. Certainly you can't kill them, but there's different halachic ramifications for that. Perhaps there would be a differentiation where Moshe is not willing to make that distinction.
Well, with point number six, I think he loads his language for using the word murder.
So we've talked about this, kill versus murder, in our Monday class.
He presumes that it's murder, and therefore he's philosophically on one bent.
So I would cut you off like this. This was not written in English.
I understand.
So we're assuming that the translator is writing the what he meant, but I would say that perhaps the translation is wrong, and according to what you're saying.
Right.
It's written in Hebrew.
I had learned long ago, and I don't know where or when, but the basic concept of that a fetus is a person until a certain point in time, and I don't remember exactly what that was, whether it was being delivered or, X weeks of gestation or a month after born or whatever, but there was a halachic definition, and if you're aborting something that's not yet a person, you're not committing murder.
Right. I just want to refer you back to the class where you did it.
And I missed some of them.
Yeah.
Sorry. So, quick answers.
No quick answer. No.
Yeah, that's all I'm here. Exactly.
And I'm also looking up on my.
So Torah Perspective. Where do I find it, Rabbi?
On the
call.org.
Okay.
Do you have a date?
You'll see the title. It'll be apparent. But it, from what I understand, it's a fascinating discussion. Let's see if we can take up the pace a bit so we can get to some questions. So we have number six, where Moshe says that he forbids the issue of abortion. So therefore, he's going to have a larger issue of doing testing that's going to lead to that. Now we mentioned that there are much more possible benefits that modern science can apply to this testing. So I'm not clear on how that would be applied today, even according to Rav Moshe, who's saying that how could you help somebody do testing if they're going to abort? Well, that's not the intention necessarily. There are many, many things that they can do. And although the Tzitz Eliezer, the first idea that we said, has this idea that he says, well, even if you're going to abort, which is not a certain thing, it might be halachically permissible, which Rav Moshe does not have, but forget about aborting for a moment. Perhaps we'll find out something that we can apply some sort of antibiotic or be ready with the right specialist in the, in the delivery room or in a place that they can do it and so on. And I believe that there are some there are some procedures that you can even do in utero. Is that correct?
Yeah, there are a few.
There are a few. So I'm not that's very prevalent, but that's something that exists. So at least today, the application of this may be different in so much as there's that possibility. But when there's something I want to read number 7, which is a bit. Once again, there's something that could be misapplied, and it's a quote. It's taken out of context in the middle of a larger piece from Rav Moshe, where he says as follows. And I'd like to explain this point as opposed to just reading it because it's important to see it in to understand it in context. He says, in general, we must know that everything is from heaven, and one cannot try to outsmart punishment. That does not mean that if you're standing in the street and the car is accelerating towards you, you should not jump out of the way. Okay, that's not what Moshe is trying to say. He's not saying that you should not seek medical attention if you're sick. That's not what he's saying. So what is he saying? What he's saying is, and that Dr. Goodman was telling us last night, is even if medicine will try to apply the greatest and fullest extent of its testing, we are not going to find a way to figure out everything and to avoid everything. So at the end of the day, this is something called standard of care. How far do you go? How crazy do we make ourselves? Now, like I said, there might be a deviation or a difference between what medical will say, and what I want to discuss a bit later in number 10, the difference between benefit, you know, the idea of benefit versus risk versus the difference between danger. But leaving that to the side for the moment, at least the idea that if something is meant to happen to us, there's only so much we can do to avoid it, helps us to get back to number 1, which is be wholehearted with God. It means, and as long as we're doing our part, we're being cautious, we're being careful, we're being reasonable. So then we're told, trust Hashem. You shouldn't be going wildly overboard, paranoid testing, and if you're concerned about a wildly low chance of something happening, and it does occur, that's not because you were irresponsible. That would have occurred in some form, whether or not you would have been responsible, because that was meant to be. There's only so much that we're required to be overly concerned with that sort of thing. Now, as far as, it may relate to something that Bruce brought up earlier, let's go on to number 8 and 9, another topic, which is that of the doctor. The doctor's place and things. So there's a verse, which is number 8. It says like this, and he shall provide for healing. Rapa Yerapa. So the Gemara in Baba Kama says, from here we infer that the permission is given to the doctor to heal. We're told that doctors have the right and to do healing. The Chassam Sofer asks a very obvious question, one that never is so obvious that it never occurred to me until I saw it yesterday. But I think it's a very obvious question. Okay? He asks as follows. He says, one way or another, this doesn't make any sense. Is the doctor working on his own outside of the purview of God's will? If that's the case, it's not going to work. We believe that everything comes from God. So what does that mean, giving permission to do some sort of silly procedure that's not going to work? What is that about? And alternatively, if he's acting as a tool of God, so then what does it mean he's given permission to perform medicine? What do these words mean? What does the Gemara mean? So the Chassam Sofer says an idea which is paraphrased in number 9 by the Tzitz Eliezer. I'm not sure if it might actually be a quote from the Chassam Sofer, not the Tzitz Eliezer, and he says as follows: God put laws of nature in place, and he wants the world to proceed based on the laws of nature. An ill person who with a doctor's supervision is taking medicine, for these medications to not cure him would be miraculous. Okay, so what he's saying is, just to pause in the middle of the quote, is he's saying that if we can test and ascertain that there is a cause and effect relationship between a certain medication or process and an illness or a defect, so then that's a fact. That becomes a natural fact. Now, if we then apply that medicine to this person who has this illness, we're not using miraculous forms. We're using normal things. And for it not to work would be miraculous. That would be out of the norm. The standard would be for it to work. This medication heals this issue. Now, obviously, there's a lot of gray area of medicine where it may not be black and white like that, where we would say for doctors not to be successful in their jobs would be miraculous. I think that would be hard to say. But that, even Dr. Goodman, who's fantastic. But that being said, you know, there's certainly this concept that medicine is a science. There's something measurable. And to the extent that it's measurable, it works. It accomplishes what it's supposed to accomplish. And therefore, what would be the logic that we'd be concerned to use it? Because we'd say, if this person's sins are so great, then maybe he won't, then God will perform a miracle and it won't work or something like that. He says, we're not concerned with that sort of situation. We're not concerned with that. Here, too, we can apply this idea. Since the gates of wisdom have been opened by heaven, so there's a concept that in the last couple hundred years, and this is really goes back even earlier, but certainly in the last couple hundred years, Rabbi Chanan Wasserman talks about this at length, there's been a tremendous plethora of new scientific developments and capabilities. And so we now have a lot of things that they didn't have a couple hundred years ago. So we can naturally remove this burden through the laws of nature with the wisdom of medicine, and it is not opposed by halacha. So what he's saying is this basic idea that the doctor's place from our perspective of Rapa Yerapa, what the Torah is telling us that you may heal, is that you can use the natural order of things and scientific discovery and apply that, and that's not called trying to work outside of godly intervention. You're using a tool of nature which God has provided for us, and that's the permission that's given to the doctor, so to speak. So the doctor's place is to use those tools, and that's not called, that's certainly not opposed to halacha, and that would not be considered not being wholehearted with God. So what the takeaway for me of that is that this is going to be a sliding scale. It's going to change as medicine changes, and as the standards of care change, and as what's considered commonplace and accepted and prudent will change. And that might even change depending, and I'm sure there's always going to be this sort of fuzzy area between what's absolutely current standard of care and what might be outside of it, because it's going to depend which doctor you go to, what's his line of specialty, what's his opinion on the prevalence and so on, and on the danger level, and these sort of things. One more idea that we talked about that I want to cover is number 10. Before we read it, I just want to talk a little bit about it. We've talked until now about a few topics. One of the topics we talked about was simply doing testing. Are you allowed to do testing, or do you need to be wholehearted and not try to find out the future? We mentioned there are those who say that's not called finding out the future. We said that even those who say that it is, as long as it's commonplace standard of care, it's fine, and as long as it's reasonable in your scenario, it would be fine. Okay, so now I want to add a new piece to this all, and that is the concept of risk. What happens when the procedure is invasive? If it has a possible deleterious effect? If it could cause damage as well? Now, certainly the minute chances of, let's say, you know, somebody taking a blood test of getting an infection some sort of blood clot, something that I'm not talking about those sort of risks. I'm talking about a larger risk. So the obvious thing that will come to mind is amniocentesis. So this is something that was, you know, hotly debated in the 70s and 80s, at least from a rabbinic perspective. And the rabbinic sources have significantly different numbers than those that Dr. Goodman gave. So, you know, certainly times have changed. And as Dr. Goodman said, the prevalence of using these things are less because we have many more non-invasive procedures. That being said, we still need to weigh the two. So here's where I want to just point out a difference perhaps between the scientific perspective and the halachic perspective. From a scientific perspective, there's a risk-benefit analysis, which is how large is the risk, let's quantify that in numbers, and then how big is the benefit, chances of benefit, and then if the benefit is even slightly over the risk level, it's at least, I don't know if it's necessary, but it would be advisable, it would be acceptable. From a halachic perspective, they may not be the case. And we can appreciate this with the background that we have from the last 15 minutes. And that is, in so much as there's a scenario where we're not required to find something out, where it's beyond the pale of what we should be checking, what we should be looking for. So then, the question of doing the testing or not doing the testing when it's unnecessary is sort of, well, you probably shouldn't do it. It's not the right thing to do. But when you're causing a small chance of damage, of danger to the fetus, or in any other scenario, so now that ramps up the issue. So perhaps, and this is what what Sicilezza is going to say, that perhaps when you're going to try to contrast a small danger versus a small benefit, even if the small benefit is a little bit bigger than the danger, but if the benefit's below the halachic threshold of that which we need to be concerned about, then the danger is enough of a reason to absolutely never do it. Not do it, not never do it, but not do it in that scenario. Let's see the quote. Is it proper for the 1.5% He's talking about the risk of danger to the fetus, which, as Dr. Goodman said today, is 1 in 500. So that's 0.02, right? As opposed to 0.02, as opposed to 1.5. It's a very significant difference to the risk of the death of the fetus. Therefore, it appears as one should not engage in amniocentesis, but rather to fulfill the injunction to be wholehearted with God. Only in a certain, but he does understand there's a scenario where it would be appropriate. And what's those scenarios? Only in a situation where the couple already gave birth to a Down syndrome child and they advise her to undergo amniocentesis, or if the woman is above the aforementioned age, which I believe is 35, is that correct?
Correct.
And she can find no rest, and I believe this is in conjunction specifically. It means if you're over the age and you're not concerned, then perhaps maybe there isn't. But he's saying at least if she's concerned, if there's a nervous issue, that she's not going to find any rest by night or day, and that's certainly a danger issue as well for pregnant women to have serious panic attacks and fear and so on. So that she's 100% sure there's no issue. In such a case, I have concluded that it is permitted. So even though he says that one shouldn't, and his numbers were much higher, nonetheless, in the case where he felt that there was enough of a need, enough of a risk factor, that we would say this is a scenario where we should be testing, that was enough of a reason to do that. So if we have the confluence...
Number 10 is all subjective.
Subjective to what?
To the perceiver.
So this is, you're making a very good point. And what it boils down to is the halachic process. Halacha is not something that you can read. Practical halacha is not something that you can just read a book and get the answers to.
Correct.
Halacha has to be is nuanced and subjective to a certain extent. Now, the greater a person has the training and has the insight and certainly the knowledge, absolutely 100% the knowledge, that is most definitely the premise behind it all and the basis behind it all. But one needs to also have shima. She has to have the ability to apply it properly. And at the end of the day, we're all dealing with the proper piece of information, but how they're set up on the board, how to weigh them, is most important. And that's why, if there's one thing that you should take away from this all, and that is that anybody who has any questions of this nature should speak to a rabbi about his personal situation. There's no carte blanche rules that come out of this. But this is understanding the background. So you're right. Some is subjective to a certain extent. Yeah.
I just want to point out the basic factor that maybe you might not realize. How seriously we take the mother's comfort and psyche to the extent that we would have two doctors, two hospitals, one was closer to them, one was farther on Sabbath, on Shabbat. We allow the woman to go to the farther hospital, even if it's just because she's more comfortable there, or, as simple as that. So it is a very, I'm sure Dr. Jones can speak to it, I have a little bit of experience.
So just to wrap one last point, so I just to finalize the final point, and that is in so much, and then we'll take questions, in so much as there are these reasons for doing a risk procedure, there's enough markers, there are And the risk is low enough, and once again, like you said, this is subjective, and therefore it has to be discussed with a competent authority, but then it would be permissible to even take a minor risk for the proposed benefit. But in so much as that wouldn't exist, then we wouldn't be allowed to do a procedure that has a small amount of risk. I'm not talking about a minute amount of risk, such as just taking a shot or something like that, possible allergies that you don't know about, that sort of thing, but something that has a significant enough amount of risk would be reason enough not to do something, even if there might be a minute benefit, as long as the threshold of what we might gain is not high enough that it would be considered common standard of care. Questions?
So are you saying the cost benefit is based upon a probability calculus?
No, it's not that simple. The cost benefit, I'm saying like this, that there's a cost benefit from the medical perspective, there's a cost benefit in LA which is number dependent. Whereas from a halachic perspective, there is a threshold, which I don't know what that is, and like I said, it's somewhat unclear. There's a threshold wherein this is a large enough thing that we need to be concerned with, and therefore it would be considered worthwhile to test. This is not a large enough thing. Now, when we're talking about something that's not below the threshold, wherever that threshold is, then if the risk factor is notable, then we're going to say, don't do it, even if the benefit is higher. Yes?
When you were first talking about 1 and 2, you used the word, the term
I probably wasn't reading as much as using the translation as I would understand. The word is tamim. Tamim can mean complete. In context, it often does mean wholesome. The way that Rabbi Fleischer, who made this sources sheet before he left town, translated was wholehearted. I believe. What's that? No. But so good point. It's very likely that the Art Scroll translated as wholehearted. In certain contexts, the word tamim, the etymology of the word, certainly leaned towards wholeness or being wholesome. But specifically, the Maharal would understand this as being complete, being simple, almost not being as much wholehearted. Yes.
I find it very interesting that testing was available. And if two people were attracted or whatever and were tested in very strong avenues of possibility of defects and whatever, what would be the stance on them still marrying and not having children?
Yeah, Moshe talks about this. I mean, I'm sorry, not Moshe. Cicely also talks about this. I'll give you an article on it. How's that? So I have one right here, actually, that I printed out. An interesting article.
I actually know people who have not gotten married.
No,
he's asking a question. What Bruce is asking is if somebody does a post-marriage test and finds out they're both carriers, what's the halachic status going forward? No, but let's say they did. Some are post-factum. They've done the test.
Well,
they've had a kid who was Tay-Sachs.
I have a sister-in-law who had a kid that was the sister of my brother. They were happily married for many years. I don't think anyone ever thought that they should, not be married anymore. And that question about kids is a different conversation.
Yes.
Dr. Griffin, sort of follow-up to yours. When I got my marriage license many years ago, there was a warning that said that if you were a Ashkenazi descent, you should get tested.
Same with me.
Yeah.
Well, both my wife and I got tested before we got married.
But I mean, it was state of Colorado.
Right. You're right.
Yeah.
I got married in New York, and they required a blossom test.
For those that don't, it's for syphilis. Yeah. And actually, Colorado used to have the same test, the Wasserman.